Okay, so last week we focused just on the two psukim of Ahivan ben Sa'aron, and we noted that that really marks the transition in Sefer Bamidbar to the tailspin of the rebellions of the Jewish people. So we're going to focus on the first of those stories. The short sheet focuses mainly on probably the most bizarre part of the story, but first you have to really look at the story. I was debating to add all the psukim to it, but some of these source sheets I knew in advance when I was teaching, like at the Bayit last year, when I was doing like Parsha Shirim, that I would use it eventually. So I had this ready. So I was like, the Psukim I can look at a Chumash. So the rebellion really starts in Parakut Aleph. This isn't here, but I'll read it if you have a Chumash. Great. But it starts by here. I'm Kimeton and Yim Rabbas Ne Adonai Vayishma Adonai Vaycharapo Vativarvam Isha Adonai Vatochal Bixem Machane. So the people started to complain, and this was evil in the ears of God, and God heard it, and His anger flared up, and the fire burned against them from God, and it consumed the edge of the camp. And they cry out to Moshe, and Moshe davens to God, and the fire stops. They call the place Tavera, because that was where God's anger had raged. So you get this three pasuk complaint story. We don't even really know what they were complaining about. The pasukim don't even really tell you, but. You know, the way Rashi says it is they were looking for something to complain about. Like, the first thing we find out is we don't even know what they're complaining about. They're just complaining and God gets angry. But this just sort of sets the tone. It's almost a contentless story. And then we get a more detailed complaint. Specifically of the man. So in Pasuk Dalet, in Berakot Aleph, they say, Vasa Sufa, Sher Bikirbo, Hit Avuta Vava Yeshivu Vayevkuga Mene Yisrael, Vayamru Mi Yachilenu Vasar. So the rabble who was on the, were in the Jewish people, so they desired a desire, or perhaps they desired to desire, and they, they started to cry, and they said, who will give us meat? Zacharnu et hadagah asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam, et hakishuim et avatichim et hachatzir et habtzalim et hashumim. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt for free, and the gourds, and the watermelons, and the onions, and the cucumbers, the onions, the garlic, v'ata nafshenu yivesha ein kol bilti alaman einenu. And now our eyes are dried up, our souls are dried up, we have nothing. All we look towards is the man. V'man, kizra gadu v'eno keina bidolach. And the man is like coriander seed, its color was the color of bidolach, of some sort of shiny gem or something, whatever exactly bidolach. Bidolach is... Rashi, you know, says shame even toe. It looks like some gem, not clear exactly what. Shatu am v'laktu v'dachnu v'reichai v'du v'dachu v'midocha u v'shlu b'parur v'asu oto ugod v'yat hamok itam l'shid m'shat hashamen. And the people would stroll around, they would gather it, they would grind the man, they would pound it into mortar, they would cook it in a pot and make it into cakes, and it tasted like dough kneaded with oil. And then the dew would come down at night, and the man would go on top of the dew. And Moshe hears the nation complaining, each at the door to his tent, and God gets angry, and it was evil in Moshe's eyes. And this is what we saw already. We jumped ahead to this last week, that Moshe, who until now had been sticking up for the Jewish people no matter what, despairs. Vayom Moshe Adonai, lama hereota lavdecha, why have you been terrible to me? To your servant, lama lavatzadichein meinecha lasumen masakal amazalai, why haven't I found favor in your eyes that you've put this burden on me? Anochi ariti et kol amazeh im anochi yelatiu, ki tomar elai so eil v'chikecha, that I give birth to them. that you should tell me to carry them, kasher yisal main and hayonek, like I should carry them like a male nurse, again, which doesn't exist, but he invents this image of the mashin shbadla or that I should carry them. Where am I supposed to get this meat from? I can't carry them because they are heavier than I. It's just too much, too heavy. If this is what you're going to do to me, so kill me. I just can't handle it. I just can't see this anymore. And God responds to him in two ways, right? One is he responds to the people, but he also responds to Moshe. So, as we said, this part of the transition here is for Moshe. So first, he deals with Moshe's problem. Vayomer Adonai Moshe, Asvali Shivim Ish Mizikne Israel, Asher Yadata, Kiyem Zikne Am, Shotrav, Lakach Lotam, Ol Moed, Vidyatzvu Sham Imach. You can't handle it by yourself? Fine. Get 70 elders that you know that they're leaders and they're officers and take them to Ol Moed and they'll be with you. You don't have to do it yourself. And my spirit will come down and speak to you and you will give your spirit to them. And they'll help you carry the burden of the nation. You won't have to do it yourself. Now, as for the Jews' complaint, tell them as follows. And tell the people that tomorrow you'll eat meat because you cried to God and you said, who's going to eat us meat? And you said it was better in Egypt. I'm going to give you so much meat, not for one day, not for two, not for five, not 10, not even 20. Al chodesh yamim, ad asher yitzei ma'abchem. You're going to have so much for 30 days. It's going to be coming out of your nose. Vayalach al nezara. It'll be nauseating to you. Yan ki ma'astem ad adonai asher b'kirbechem v'tivku lefanav le'mor lamaza yatzanu mimitzrayim. Because you've hated God. And you said, why did you take us out of Egypt? Vayom Moshe, sheish me'od elef raglia am asher nochi v'kirbo v'ata marta basarte le'em v'achlu chodesh yamim. And Moshe said, there's over 600,000 people. You're going to give them all meat. Atzunu v'akai yishachei le'em v'atza lehem. What, I'm going to kill all the meat that they have? And called the gate, hayam yasef le'em v'atza lehem. How are you going to find all of this for them? So then God continues, and I'll summarize and we'll come to it if we need. And God says, what do you mean? You think the hand of God can't do this? You'll see. You'll see if this happens. And he goes, he gets 70 skeinim, and God brings these quail. There's the story of Eldad and Medad in the middle, so I'll skip that. And he brings the quail. And he blows them in. If you skip down, this wind brings the quail from the sea, from a day's journey on each side, and there's 2 cubits worth, so 5-6 feet worth of 3-4 feet rather of quail just piled up in the whole camp, tremendous amount of meat. Everyone gathered, even the least of them had 10 chomer, tremendous amount of meat. And while they were still eating the meat, God's wrath flared against them. And he struck them. And they called this the place of burial for those who desired, because that's where those who desired were buried. And then they traveled to the next city. So this is the first, as I said, real rebellion story in Bamidbar. The people come and they said, we are sick of the man. We hate the man. We can't take it. We don't want it. And Moshe gets angry, and Hashem gets angry. So first Hashem says to Moshe, look, you can't handle it, so let me solve that problem. Then in the middle, we get that story of Eldad and Medad, which maybe we'll come back to. He appoints this Canaan, and specifically Eldad and Medad have this prophecy in the camp. And then he deals with the people, and he gives them this magical quail, piles and piles of piles of meat. But he's so angry, they're eating the meat, and they just die. During it, and they call the place the burial of those the place of burial for those who complained. And the question you really have to ask in the story is what is going on? Like, why are they? What is different about this complaint? First of all, why, what are they really complaining about? And two, why is it so bad that Moshe loses his cool? And we've seen that's clearly what happens. This is the first time that Moshe really loses his cool with the people. But what are they complaining about? Why is he so angry? And I think the key to that lies in what is perhaps the most bizarre pasuk in this entire unit, which is the one I put on the source sheet here, which is, just to look at it again, right? Zacharnu et hadagash enochal mimitzrayim chinam. We remember the fish that we ate for free. We remember the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. And Chazal pick up on this already, that if you want to figure out what is so bad about this story, you just got to look at that pasuk and say, what is going on? And the Jewish people were slaves in Egypt. And now they're idealizing Egypt. And, you know, the psukim itself seem to indicate that that is really what is what's different here. Because when describing why he's so angry... right, in Pasuk Chaf, we'd seen, he said, why is he so angry? Why is he going to punish them and give them the 30 days of meat, but let that kill them? Kimastem and Hashem, because they hated God, they rejected God. Asher b'kibachem v'tivku lefanav lemor, lama zeh yatzanu mimitzrayim. And they asked, why did you take us out of Egypt? Because really, what Hashem and Moshe are picking up on is that by saying, we remember the fish, and we remember the garlic, and we remember all of that in Egypt, what they're really saying is, we want to go back. But this is a change that we haven't seen yet. They've rebelled before against the Jewish people, but this is new. And if you want to sort of put it in the starkest possible terms, to really identify how bad this is, right, before this moment, before Shemot, what was undeniably the worst sin that the Jews had committed since they left Egypt?
Golden calf?
Yeah, there you go, right? The golden calf. This is massive of the Zara. It's terrible. It's atrocious. And in that moment, Moshe sticks up for them. There's nothing to say. They've just come down from Harsinai. They've just left Harsinai. They've just seen God, and they replace God with this golden calf, and Moshe sticks up for them. And now they want food, and they don't like man, and Moshe loses his cool. But what would make him lose his cool now, if not then? So you could just say, well, he's just tired, right? You know, when you first get into a job, you have a certain level of fortitude, and then eventually you just break down. They wear at you. But it seems to be that there's something more going on here, because even the Egel, what is the rallying cry of the Jewish people at the Egel? Right, they say, this is our God.
Spiritual.
Right, but what does they say? How do they describe him? Right, they say, we want a God. Eile Elohecha Yisrael, Asher Halucha Meretz Mitzrayim. This is your God who took you out of Egypt. Now they're rejecting God or Moshe, whatever they're doing, but they are, no one ever said, we want to go back to where we were. They may replace God, but they recognize that they are in a new stage. They've moved on from Egypt. They maybe worship idolatry, but Moshe can say, I can work with this. If you don't idealize the path, you recognize that we've moved on from Egypt, so as big as a mistake as you're going to make, I can handle it. But here, you know, Moshe and Hashem read between the lines. When they say, we remember the fish in Egypt, or we remember the watermelons and the cucumbers in Egypt, and that's why we're upset, because we don't have meat, we only have man. They're not really saying, I want meat. They're really saying, we want to go back to Egypt. And that's why Hashem reads between the lines. And if you look, that's really what he's doing. They say, we remember the fish in Egypt. And Hashem interprets it as, Ma'astem and Hashem asher bikir bechem, batifku lefanav lemor, lama zeh yatzanu mimitzrayim. You rejected God and said, why did we leave Egypt? But they never said, why didn't we leave Egypt? But God is saying, yes, you did. We all know what changed, why Bamidbar is so bad. and why this is the first in a series of rebellions that ends with the Maraglim is because this is the first time that the Jews' rebellion leads them to question whether their entire journey was worth it. They're denying here their national story. And if you think about it, the ultimate crime that they commit that seals their fate is the Maraglim. And that's when they say, don't bring us to Israel. We wish, right, Nit Narosh v'Nashuva Mitzrayim, let's turn back to Egypt. But that sentiment, that it's not just that we're going to rebel, but that if we're not happy, we're just going to pretend this never happened. The first time that happens is right here. And Moshe, it seems, can't handle that. He just can't handle it. And that notion, I think that's why Chazal pick up correctly on the fact, I think, that pasuk is the key to the whole story. So if you look at the number two, the Gemara has a machloket, Rav and Shmuel debate. And they say, what could it possibly mean? So Chad Omar, Dagim. V'chad Omar, Arayot. One said, when they say we remember the fish, it means that they really means the fish. V'chad Omar, Arayot. And one said, nah, that can't be what it means. What it means is we remember the Arayot. We remember that we used to have less forbidden sexual relationships. Dichtiv, nochal, because it said we will eat, which sometimes has a more metaphorical reading. Mandamar Arayot. One said Arayot. Mandamar Dagim. The one who thinks this means fish literally said Dichtiv, nochal, because it said we remember what we used to eat. But one of them said, no, when they said we want fish, it can't mean fish. And you know what the key word in this whole story is? Chinam. Because they commemorate Egypt and they say we used to eat for free. What do you mean you used to eat for free? You never ate for free, you were a slave. So it can mean they mean it. And what he's reading in is that they say fish. They say it's about the food. But it's not really. It's what Hashem says at the end. It's Me'astemote, you hated me, and you said you want to go back to Egypt. You're not commemorating Egypt because of the fish. Right? What you want is chinam. You wanted, as the way Rashi will quote it, if I put it here, from the Sifrei, we'll come to it a bit later, is chinam min ha-mitzvot. Right? What you're really bothered about is not the fish. It's by regretting that you left, by looking back, what you're really saying is you regret Matan Torah, you regret the relationship with me. This is all a pretense. And the Mefarshim all sort of debate, how do you see that in the Psukim? Because it's clear, they don't mean what they say. So the Mefarshim try to figure out two things. One is, what are they actually, what is their claim on the surface? And then the question is, well, what do they mean? Which are both important to figuring out what is new here. So if you look at number three, the Mechilta says as follows: Relazar Hamodai Omer, Avadim Hayu Yisrael Melachim Mitzrayim. When the Jews were in Egypt, they were servants to kings. Mitzrayim Yatzu Lashuk Notlin Pat Basar V'Dagim V'Chol Davar V'Engol Briyam Ochev Yadam. So they would go to the market; they could take whatever they want: bread, meat, fish, whatever they want. They would go into the fields and they would get fruits. And whatever they wanted, and no one would stop them. So Relezer Hamodai says, you know what? Like the first position in the Gemara in Yoma, when they say, we remember the fish we used to eat, he meant it. They did have fish. They had great food. Why? Because they worked for the king. And if you work for the king, he suggests that maybe they could take whatever they want, they could eat whatever they wanted. And they missed that. So when they say, we remember the fish, they mean it literally. So then how does the pasuk know that they're not really just reminiscing about the food? Well, because what's implicit in his statement is, it's not that they regret the food, it's they regret that they used to be servants to Paro, and that was a better lifestyle than being servants to God. So Yes, they're complaining about the fact they don't have fish. They used to have really good food, and now they just have man. But they used to be fed because they were servants of Paro. Now they're fed man because they're servants of God. And the fact that they could care about the food without contextualizing it means that what they're really... with here, it's, I don't know if they're actively rejecting God, but they are obviously, implicitly not seeing the value in being a servant of God over the servant of Paro. The Ramban takes it a bit differently. He said, you're right. They ate, they really meant it. When they ate food, fish for free, they did. How did they eat fish for free? So Elazar Hamodayat said, well, they were servants of the king. Everyone gave them food. He thinks it actually means in a certain respectable way they had food. But the Ramban says, no, lefi pshuto, ki ayo dayagim ha-mitzriyim ma'avidin otan lemshel ha-dagim shenachan zim mitzudav machmarot. So what happened was that they were servants to the fishermen. If you're a servant to a fisherman, you eat fish. That's what happens. And they would let them eat fish like any other person who works for a fisherman. What about all of the vegetables that they mention? He said, Mitzrayim is described as the garden, as a vegetable garden. It was a very, very fertile land. There were wild vegetables that grew everywhere. So when they used to work as gardeners, as part of their slavery, or as field hands in the fields, so they would eat vegetables. Of course they had vegetables and they had fish. Alternatively, he quotes Rav Zalman Daisha, Hayusham Yisrael, Avdei HaMelech, Hosim Melachto, Vayam Mefarneis Otam Belechem Tzar. Or they were servants of the king, and he wouldn't give them much food, right? He would give them a little bread, of a mayim lachatz, and a limited amount of water. And no one would stop them from eating whatever they wanted because they worked for the king. So Rilazar Hamodai says that when they say they ate fish, they mean they really ate fish. And they really had good food because they were servants of the king. The Ramban has two positions. Either they mean the fish was really free, because like Rilazar Hamodai, they worked for the king, so no one stopped them from eating it. Or alternatively, they had food just because they got to eat whatever they were working on. Shadal has another interpretation of how they got free food. And he says, yeah, chinam mimash, it was free. The Egyptians would give them food so that they could work. They fed them food that was cheap, and it was very prevalent in Egypt. And that's what we find by Herodotus. So the Mechilta, Ramban, Shadal all say, when they complain about food, and they say, we used to have food for free, they mean it literally. We had food for free, either because we were servants of the king, or because they needed food, so they just ate from whatever they were working on. Or, he said, no, it wasn't even that they would take it. Maybe, Shadal said, they were actually fed food. But the problem is that even if it's true, that when they say we remember the food, and it was free, even if it really was free, and even if, as Shadal said, the government was really giving it to them, they were actually being fed. The fact that they're reminiscing about free food means they've totally missed the context of their experience in Mitzrayim and their new experience. Because the common denominator of all those commentaries, whether you think that it was a sign of honor, they were servants of the king, so they were fed by the government, or you say that they were servants of the king and therefore no one would stop them if they wanted food, or you say it's to their degradation. They were slaves and they were fed cheap stuff, or they were fed the leftover what they were working on. It doesn't matter. It's all marginal compared to the fact that they only got that food because they were slaves. And as honorable as a position it might have been to be a slave to Paro, you were still a slave. And the fact that you can reminisce, and the fact that you can idealize that, means, as Hashem said, Lama ma, right, ma'astem et Hashem, you hate me, because you're saying, why did I leave Egypt? You'd rather be a slave, an honored slave in Egypt, apparently, than being with me. That's how you can reminisce about this food. But it's even more than that. It's not just that you remember that experience and you're idealizing it, meaning you don't really want to be with me. You also forget that when you were there, nobody cared about you. Even if they gave you food, it wasn't because they cared. And that's what Chardal is getting at. He said, yeah, maybe the government did pay them food, but why did he give them food? Why did someone feed their slaves? Someone feeds their slaves because they want their slaves to survive so that they'll have live slaves. It's not because they like you, they care about you. You're reminiscing about that when your alternative is God who's feeding you man from heaven? Are you out of your mind? I gave you just in six to illustrate this. This is a fascinating book. It's called The Dictator's Handbook. Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. It's a very good book by two political theorists, Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alastair Smith. They've developed a theory called selectorate theory, which their basic theory of politics is that all governments, dictatorships, democracies, doesn't matter, are all basically boiled down to one principle, which is that 99.9% of leaders, the only thing they care about at the end of the day is staying in power. They have exceptions. They have few leaders that they like, right, in the history of the world, like George Washington. And the only reason they like George Washington is because they said he willingly gave up power. He was the president who set the precedent that presidents should voluntarily give up running after two terms, which wasn't law until the 1940s. It was only after Roosevelt that became law in the United States. But after Washington, until Roosevelt, no president ever tried for a third presidency because Washington had stepped down. Right? This became a whole song in Hamilton. Right? When right, he, if you've either seen the play or listened to the soundtrack, at some point Alexander Hamilton is called in by President Washington before what would be his third run for president, and he tells him, Alexander, I'm not running a third time, I'm stepping down. He said, why? The people love you, they want you. If you run, you'll win forever. If you want to be president, you'll be president forever. And he said, yes, but the most important lesson I can teach them is teach them how to say goodbye. Right? His role as president, he felt, was to teach people that this is not a monarchy, it's a democracy, and therefore no president has power forever. But most leaders don't do that. And their theory is that all governments, the leader wants to stay in power, so why is it that democracies tend on average to be less corrupt than monarchies? Because you're answerable to more people. And since everyone wants to stay in power, You always have to make the people who keep you in power happy. In a dictatorship, it's the power, it's the maybe the military, maybe the bankers, maybe the wealthy people who keep you in power. In democracy, it's everybody keeps you in power because you need them to vote you in. Therefore, to make them happy, you have to do good things for the average person. That's why democracies end up better. But most people, even democracy, it's a very cynical book. But in that book, one of the things they know is that dictatorships, we tend to think of as terrible places. But you look at a place like North Korea. In North Korea, there are certain things about North Korea that seem really good. So, for example, North Korea has and the evidence seems to bear this out, 100% literacy, which is crazy. Right, it's amazing, and some people point to that and say, "Hey, it's not so bad to have, dictatorships, and they have very, very low levels of poverty, of absolute poverty, of starvation." So people point to North Korea and they say, "Oh, North Korea is a great place," but and we can look at it inside. He said, "No, it's not true." He said, "Look, from a leader's point of view, the most important function of the people is to pay taxes. All regimes need money. As a result, certain basic public goods must be made available even by the meanest autocrat unless he has access to significant revenue from sources like oil or foreign aid that are not based on taxing workers." He said, unless you are, and this is why you see the most human rights violations in countries with a lot of oil, unless you have a lot of natural resources and you can get money, without taxation, you have to keep the people alive because they provide the money, either through taxation or work or whatever. These policies are not instituted for the betterment of the masses, even though, of course, some members of the masses, especially workers, benefit from them. It's true, you benefit from them, but it's not for you. And then he writes this about education, which is high in autocracy, but only at elementary levels. Example, literacy in North Korea is 100%. So the rules of politics, as we know, instruct leaders to do no more for the people than is absolutely essential to prevent rebellion. Leaders who spend on public welfare at the expense of their essentials are courting disaster. These leaders, whether dictators or Democrats, are all grappling with the same question. How much education is the right amount? For those who rely on a few essential backers, the answer is straightforward. Educational opportunities should not be so extensive as to equip ordinary folks, the interchangeables, to question government authority. So if you look at a place like North Korea, it's true. You have 100% basic literacy because the people need to read the laws, they need to work, they need to do basic things to keep the government in power. But they have among the lowest number in the world of anybody with secondary education. Because they provide them exactly what they need and no more. Enough to keep them alive and functioning, and not enough to get them to think for themselves because they could rebel. And the same thing is true of food. There's very low starvation rates in North Korea, but there's very little wealth outside of the inner circle. Because when whichever leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-il, whatever, Kim Jong-un, whatever I pronounce it, they want to keep their people alive so they can be in the military, so they can work, they can provide taxes, all that, and they don't want them to be strong enough and smart enough to rebel against them. If you idealize that situation, you're denying the inherent value in having a society where people have worth in and of themselves, where they have the freedom to make decisions. You're reducing people's value, or you're reducing goodness towards people to, do I keep them alive on bare subsistence? But you don't ask the question, are they living a good life? Do they have the right to make meaningful decisions? Shaddal is really getting at that. He's saying, look, if the Jews are commemorating that they got food for free, that's like someone in North Korea saying, hey, look how great the supreme leader is in North Korea because all of us can read at a third grade level. Enough to read the decrees or the laws of North Korea. But that's missing the point, which is, yeah, but he doesn't let you get educated beyond a third grade level because he doesn't want you to think. He doesn't want you to do anything meaningful with your life. He wants you to function at bare subsistence level. So if the Jews are talking about how they ate food for free, sure. But that's like saying, thank God, in North Korea they have 100% literacy. The leader must really care about us. No. The reason in America, Canada, England, there isn't 100% literacy is because the government thinks there's value in people making up their own minds, so we can encourage it, but we're not going to force you at gunpoint to learn how to read. We'll encourage you, we'll mandate education, but if you want to drop out at the age of whatever it is, 16 or whatever late age you're allowed to drop out of school without having learned to read, you never passed. Never learned to read. I can't force you. I can say you have to be in school for X number of years. But after that, you don't want to know how to read, so don't know how to read. It's your problem. We recognize that we can't insist on 100%, because we insist on 100%, that means we're not giving you the freedom to make basic decisions. So, if the word chinam means free, it really means that they got food for free. What their sin seems to be is the fact that they can idealize means that they've cut out of the whole context. They don't care that it was because Paro was using them so that they could provide work for him. They don't even care. It's as if they're okay with being a slave to Paro. They don't appreciate the fact that God has given them the opportunity to have a meaningful life. And that's when God and Moshe both have a meltdown. And he said, really? Right? At least the Egel, you said, this is the idol that took you out of Egypt. At least you recognize that that was a bad situation, and living in the new situation with the Torah is good. Even if you're worshiping idols, there's something better about appreciating that we're out of that situation because now you can move forward. But if you're going to go back, you're going to whitewash what was going on. You're not going to value your current life. Then we basically have no hope. And Moshe gives up hope. The to see just one source, one more source on this, this is in the Midrash HaTorah, which is a source that I don't know what it is really, but Nechama Leibovich did, so she quotes it, but I don't know what it is exactly. He quotes, and you can look at the English here, he explains as follows. He says, in Mishle 12, it says, a righteous person knows the soul of his animal, and the mercy of an evil one is cruel. This means that the good person knows his animal's soul, knowing the exertion of seven paras is enough for it, and feeds it a kav of barley, which is needed for this task. The evil person gives it the effort of 2 to 3 kav, and the next day exerts it double its walking. This is the true reason that he is merciful on it, to give it double food. It is cruel to give it more than its ability and norm, and make it satiated to work with hard work without mercy. He said, you know, let's put a slightly different spin on it. It's not just that they're doing it for their own sake. The more they give you, the more Paro gives, the more he expects from you. If he magically gives you fish one day, you know tomorrow is going to be a hard day at work. Right? You know that if, because he doesn't want you to collapse in the middle of the day, right? So if you come into work, you know, as a slave, and instead of the normal breakfast that you have, and normally you had a basic, I don't know, you know, he just put out boxes of Cheerios, enough to have a breakfast and that's it. And then one day he has a bagel, you know, a bagel breakfast. It's not because it's Hanukkah, he brought in a bagel breakfast, yay. It's because he brought it in because we need a carb, right? I need a carb load them because they're going to have a long day in the field. The more they give, the more they expect. It's all for them. And again, if you're going to talk about how good they were, you're saying it was because, oh, Paro did it for our sake. No, he didn't do it for your sake. God does it for your sake. You know what? Yeah, let's skip down to 13. If you want to see this notion of that's what's going on, it becomes clear, and this is something that David Foreman notes. If you look back at the Mun originally, right, their complaint is about the Mun. So he points out something striking, that if you look at the story of the Mun, this is in the left-hand side of 13, so the Pesukim reads as follows, Vayomer Adonai Moshe, Inim Amtir Lachem Lechem Min HaShamayim V'yatzam V'lachtu Dvar Yom B'yomo L'mana Nesenu Eilech B'torati Yimlo. God says to Moshe, I'm going to rain down bread from heaven, and the Jews will go out, and they'll collect things every day, to test them if they will keep my Torah. So the first thing that's weird is that God is apparently giving the Jews bread, giving them man, but somehow that's the test of whether they keep the Torah. So what does that mean? So we'll have to hold that thought. But if you continue to soak him, it says, Vayab yom ha-shishi ve'achinu et asher yaviu, Vayab mishneh al asher yolketu yom yom. On the sixth day, there would be a double portion. And zeh davar asher tzivadu noy lakdumenu ish lo fiachlo, omer la gogolet, mispar nafshot echem, ish la asher ba'alo tikachu. This is what God commanded. Each person should collect as much as they can eat, an omer per person, according to the number of souls that you have. And the Jews collected, whether they had more or less. There was this miracle that no matter how much mun you collected, a literal or a lot, by the time you got home, there was the exact same quota. On day 6, meaning on Friday, there was a double portion, and they told the leaders who told Moshe, "Vayomer alehem, Hu asher diber Adonai Shabbaton Shabbat Kodesh l'Adonai Machar, et asher tofu ifu, et asher tivashlu basheilu, et kol ovdei v'nichu lachem l'shmer ad haboker." That's what God said, that the seventh day is your Shabbos, is your day of rest. Whatever you're going to bake or cook for tomorrow, do it now. And that's it. If you look on the right-hand side, Roy Foreman notes that a lot of the themes in the Mun story appear actually in the story of the bricks, when Paro instructs the Jews to make bricks. So he says, Vayomer Elohe Avrim Nikra Aleinu. Moshe says to Paro, the God of the Jews called us, and he said, Nelchana Derech Shlosh Yamim Bad Marvin Nizmachala La Hashem Elokeinu Ben Evgenu Bad Evar Acharev. And he said, go serve me, And if we don't, then God might strike us down. And Moshe says, Paro says to Moshe, why are you bothering the people? Let them go back to their slavery. And Paro said, why are you making them rest? So he commands the overseers and their officers. Don't give them straw anymore, but they like you used to. But that quota of bricks, keep the same because they're lazy. That's why they're saying, let's worship God. Let them work harder and let them not hope with this false hope. So the officers go out and tell the Jews, this is what God, Paro said, I won't give you any more straw. So go, but I want your quota to be the same, because I'm not reducing it all. So now they run around the whole nation to find, the whole country to find straw. And then each day they would count their quota to make sure everything was the same. So at 14, I gave you the similarities. If Foreman notes that there seems to be a very close connection between these two stories. Both of these stories are about a servant and their master. It's the Jews, specifically the servants. In one, it's Paro. In one, it's God. Both of the stories are about quotas. Quotas that are essential to this. But the quotas are completely different. In both cases, God or Paro command the Jews to collect and come up with a quota every day. But Paro, his quota is, make me a quota of bricks. In the man, God says, collect every day, and it's for you. I command you to get food for yourself. And each of them have this emphasis on Dvar Yom B'Yomo. The theme of both units is Shabbat, ironically, is Shabbat. We don't think about it, but the focus of the man story is that it's really a background to the fact that on Friday they come to Moshe and said, why is there double? And Hashem tells Moshe to tell them, because on Shabbos it's a day of rest, so I'm letting you get double on Friday so you don't have to bother collecting on Shabbos. And what's really the theme of the brick story is that Moshe came to Paro and said, we want to go take a break and serve God. And Paro said, no, no breaks. If you have time for breaks, you're lazy. So I'm going to increase the workload without decreasing the quota, because you're not allowed to have a Shabbos, right? You're not allowed to have, or that's the word that comes up, tishbitu, right? You can't, right, where is it? Vishpatem otam misiv lotam. That's really the language. You're giving them a Shabbos. You're giving them a Sabbath from their rest. That's what you want. And in both of them, there's a focus on the double collection. Paro, when they realize that they have too much time on their hands, keeps the quota the same and doubles the workload. Hashem doubles his gift to them so that they can have a Shabbos. And Rav Foreman says, it seems to be that Hashem is trying to explain to the people the difference in their experience in Mitzrayim versus their experience of the life of Torah. Paro set quotas for you every day because he needed you to work, and therefore he didn't want you to rest. I want you to want to serve me. But to prove to you that I'm not doing this for my sake, I'm doing it for your sake, I'm going to set a quota for you that has nothing to do with me. I'm setting you a quota that no matter how much work you put in, right, Paro wanted you to put in more work to get the same amount, and no more food, no more resources. If let's say you collect too little one day, I'll magically bring it up to the right quota. Because I don't care how much work you put in. I just want you to have food. And I'm going to give you a Shabbos. You know why? Because the reason I want you to serve me is not for me. I don't need you to work for me. Here, I'll give you the day off. Right? I'll give you magic food. No matter how little you collect, when you get home, you'll have a perfect quota. I want you to collect food because I care about you. I want you to have a Shabbos because I think it's good for you to serve me instead of Paro.
And Hashem is trying to set himself up as the anti-Paro. And he said that's why it opens up. Why is getting Mun the test of Lamana Nasenu Eilech B'Torati Imlo? Why is it whether the Jews will appreciate the Mun, the test of whether they'll be able to keep the Torah? Because the test of whether they'll be able to internalize that the relationship they have with God is the opposite of the relationship they had with Paro. If you can't get that, you won't succeed as an Oved Hashem. And that breaks down in our parsha. That's really what's happening, is the fact that they turn to the Mun and say, I don't want this Mun. I don't want this magic food that gives me. I like Mitzrayim better. It means they haven't internalized that. They haven't recognized that Paro was a leader who worked them and gave them resources only because he wanted his own benefit. And to the extent that he gave them anything, it was because he wanted more for himself and needed to give them food. But when he realized they were lazy and could get the same number of bricks without giving them straw, so I'll force you to do that. Meaning, I just care about the bottom line. If I can cut down on what I give you and you'll still get the same bottom line, I'll take it away from you. Hashem says, no, I care about your bottom line. No matter how much work you put in, I'll keep giving you money. And I'll give you a Shabbos because I want you to rest. I care about you for you. But if you don't get that, you won't be able to live a life of Torah. And in our parsha, it fails. It's specifically the mun that's the axis. And that's why Moshe breaks down. That's one interpretation of this story. Another, though, is that it goes straight, not by implication, but they complain directly about their relationship with God. So if you look at 9, I gave you just parenthetically, the Toldot Yitzchak can't believe that they got free food, and therefore he says it must be the fish was rotten, right? That they're, you know, it was free food, but it was rotting food, and the fact that they can commemorate it just shows that they don't understand anything. But I think the simple shot is different, is maybe they got good food, but they didn't contextualize it. They didn't realize that Paro was in it for himself, and that's why he gave them anything. And Hashem's in it for their good. Hashem wants us to serve him because he cares about us. The other tradition is to say that no, chinam, when they say chinam, they're directly, they're saying food, they don't mean it. So the Sifrei puts it, zacharnu at the daga. We remember the fish. He said, v'chi yesh banyan shemitzrim notim lem dam gem b'chinam. You think the Egyptians gave them fish for free? But lo kvar nemar, in Red Shmot, hey, v'atem lechu evdu v'tevin lo ninyatein lachem. They didn't even give them straw. You think it gave them food? You think they gave them fish? They didn't give them straw for free. You think they gave them fish? What are they really saying? We want to be free of mitzvot. Right? They're saying fish. What they mean is chinam. We want to be free. Right? We, and this is even more direct. Right? What is the Midrash getting at? What they're complaining about is, when we were freed from Egypt, we don't view working for God as a privilege. We view it as servitude. And we'd rather go back. Relatively, we want that chinam. Because in Egypt, we may have been slaves, but we had no moral responsibilities. We didn't have mitzvot. This isn't freedom with ethical, with a privilege of leading an ethical life and a religious life. This is servitude. When they say chinam, what they really mean is chinam mina mitzvot. We're not complaining about the food. Right, read between the lines. What they want is freedom from God. They're just saying food, but that's not what they mean. Or the Kli Yakar, right, takes it further. He says, They hated the land. They hated Eretz Yisrael, for they were cavalier of heart and distant from charity. He said, you know why they're complaining now? Because they're about to go into Israel. They can't handle the mitzvot they have already. Eretz Yisrael comes with more mitzvot. It's the land where we're supposed to build a nation for God. And they're looking at it, and they're not really complaining about their existence in the desert. They're thinking, wait a second, we're about to go into Israel. When we were in Egypt, we got food, we survived, and we didn't have a responsibility to build a nation for God. We're about to go into Israel, where we're going to have to build an ethical nation. I can't do that. We can't do that. So they said, we remember the fish we ate in Egypt for free. So the Sifrei said, free from mitzvot. What they mean is, right, he puts a specific on it. Yeah, because In Israel, every last thing we're going to have is going to have religious connotations. We're going to get food, and we're going to have to give a percentage of it to God, to Trumot and Maasrot. I don't want to eat and have to be reminded about God every time I eat. I want to go back to Egypt. If that's the alternative, then don't bring me into a land where everything, including the food I eat, is imbued with sanctity and spirituality and comes with ritual obligations. Get me out of here. Get me back to the world of Mitzrayim, or the Toldot Yitzchak. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hevina Emet. He said, where Chazal aren't telling you that the words Chinam, min Chinam min HaMitzvot. They're telling you not what they said, what they meant. It's God reading between the lines. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hevina Emet, kamo shamar Asaf. He understood the truth. Vayinasu bil vavam l'shol l'chol l'nafsham, amru l'chal el l'aroch shulchan b'midbar. What is he referencing? He references 12. He doesn't make this up. He said, you know who understood this? The author of Tehillim. Because you look at Tehillim Ayin Chet, when they retell this story, this is how the story is retold. Ki lo ha'aminu ve'elohim v'lo vatchu b'shuato. They didn't trust God. They didn't believe in his salvation. V'yitzav shchakim imal v'dalte shamayim p'tach. How do I know? Because he'd commanded the skies above. He'd opened the doors of heaven, right? God had opened up heaven itself and sent them magic food from the sky. He'd given them man, they rained man down for food, giving them heavenly grain. Each man ate a hero's meal. He sent them provision in plenty. God had been raining food from heaven for them. And what did they say? He'd rained meat on them. In this parsha, he gave them meat from heaven. He'd given them bird and poultry, like sand of the sea. And he made it fall around the makom of the Mishkan. Right, our parsha, not only did he give you man, but when they complained about it, you gave them food. You gave them meat. And they ate, and they were satiated, and they got what they craved. Lo zarumi tavatam od ochlam b'fihem, and they had not wearied of what they craved. The food was still in their mouths. I should have given you the last puzzle, but the psukim right before, I just gave it. Now I see what I did, just to save space. But two psukim before this, four psukim before this, is the end of what the Toldot Yitzchok quoted was. Vayinasu el bilvavam. They tested God l'shol ochel and avsham to ask food for their soul, saying hayuchal el laroch shulchan b'midbar. Can God set a table in the desert? Right, when they were asking for food, what they were really saying is we don't trust in God. God opened heaven for you for food, and then when you complained about meat, he gave you meat. But it's not about the man, and it's not about the meat, and it's not about anything. So you don't believe in God. You didn't trust in him. You thought he couldn't give you food. You thought he couldn't take care of you, or you didn't want him to take care of you. It's not about the food. So whether you think that the word chinam means literally free, and the Jews are saying, we really got free food, and they did. Or you think chinam is symbolic. It means we want to be free from mitzvah. The point is the same. If they're commemorating how good things were in Egypt, physically, it's because they don't appreciate the new context. Or the second position of Chazal, they're directly attacking that context and saying, we don't like mitzvot, we'd rather be free of responsibility. But either way, it's a lack of recognition, as Rai Forman puts it with Man, that the fact that God gave them food every day and didn't ask for, I mean, he asked for something in return, he asked for obedience, but not for him, but for us. How do you know? Because he gave us Shabbos. He gave us a time to rest. He said, look, I want you to have time when you're off. I don't need you to collect every day. I'll give you enough for 2 days so you have a day off each week. I'm doing this for you. I'm trying to get you to understand that. If you don't realize that being a slave to Paro, where anything he gives you is just to squeeze more work out of you because he doesn't care about you, and therefore if he's giving you food, it's because he wants you to work harder that day, and therefore when he realizes that he can squeeze more out of you without giving you, he doesn't have to give you straw and you'll get the same number of bricks. He will. And you can't appreciate that that's different than me giving you free food and giving you a Torah with responsibilities. Not because I need you to work for me, as it says in Navi. I don't need you. You think it makes a difference to God if you do mitzvot? He's doing it for you. If you can't realize that the servitude to God is a privilege and the servitude to Paro is slavery, and therefore you don't want to go to Israel, you want to go back to Egypt, then this is all over. It won't work. This experiment of taking a nation for myself is just going to fail. And that's really what Moshe collapses at, right? Moshe unravels because even at the Egel, they recognize we left Egypt. We're better off now. They may have been unclear on who God was and how you were supposed to relate to him, but at least they were open to a new type of living where they were in Egypt. They had some religiosity. They were looking for an Elohim. Whoever that Elohim is, they were open to a religious lifestyle out of Egypt. That, you can work with them. You can, even as big as the mistake is, you can work for it. But when they start reminiscing and whitewashing and dreaming about a slavery with no moral responsibilities, with no freedom to make meaningful decisions, and that's more important to them than a life of living with God and the responsibilities that are actually meaningful that come with it, then this is never going to work. And that's how the pasuk describes it, that Moshe and Hashem are so angry because it's not really about the food. It's ma'astemoti, you don't like me, you hate me. Vatifkulef anav, what you're really saying is not, we remember the food. Let me read between the lines. You're saying, Lamazei Yatzanu Mitzrayim. You're saying, why'd I leave Egypt? And that's why you start to see Moshe go crazy and unravel. And that really explains, because you know, you wonder, and we'll get to it, the most famous story in Bamidbar, the Meraglim. You wonder, how did we get to the Meraglim? Like, how did we reject Israel? How did we turn our back on it? But the truth is, it starts right here. Because this is the first time they say it. It's they say, we're scared of this. We don't want responsibility. We don't want God. We don't want to build a nation for him. The Meraglim isn't the first time they reject Israel. It's right here where they reminisce about Egypt. The second they start to reminisce about Egypt as if it was good and they forget the new context they're in, they're not ready for Israel. And therefore, we shouldn't be surprised when it gets to the Meraglim, because that's just the logical conclusion. Now they're reminiscing about Egypt, and just a few prakim, they're saying, let's, right, Narosh, v'nashuv Mitzrayim, they're going to say, let's go back. Because once you idealize it, the next step is to try to reverse history, is try to turn back history. And that's why this sin will eventually be the reason they stay in the Midbar and they can never go into Israel, because they haven't gotten out of that mentality. They haven't freed themselves. And that's the second half of Bamidbar, really all comes down to this change of mentality that begins to be evident already in this first complaint story.